This episode is brought to you by HP Plus. In a world full of smart devices, isn't it about time your printer got smart too? Now printing is smart with HP Plus, and the HP Smart app is how it all happens. You can print from your phone with just a tab, no matter where you are, even from your garage / home office / yoga studio. Huh, that is smart. HP Plus. Learn more about smart printing at hp.com/smart. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/us/getQR code.
Welcome to the Washed Up Evo podcast. Today we welcome Mr. Frank Turner, also known for his time in Million Dead. Truly an honor to have you on the podcast. Thanks for taking the time.
It is a great pleasure. I do a lot of interviews, but it's rare for me to look forward to them. But we're going to get into this. But emo, in the old sense of the word, was a massive part of my musical upbringing, and in something I don't actually talk about all that often.
Well, I was looking for in the bunch. I was like, all right, I don't want to cover stuff he's already covered, and you really You sort of touch on it, but then I don't think. I don't know, interviewers don't go that deep or realize the connections.
Well, also, we're diving right in the deep end here. Because of what happened to the word emo and what it sort of turned into meaning something that to me was very different from what it meant when I first came across it as a concept, I kind of can't be asked to explain that every single time that the word comes up in conversation, so I generally avoid it.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about growing up listening to punk rock music, but I always feel that, like, you know, to me, emo was a subdivision of punk rock, and, you know, I think of Get Up Kids as being a punk band, essentially. Or at least, they're sort of under that umbrella in my head. That's right, maybe it's wrong, I don't know. But that, so I that's probably why it doesn't sort of get mentioned all that much in public. But it is definitely, it was a huge thing for me.
That's great. No, I mean, obviously, personally, getting into it, like, music-wise, like, what was that? What was that person? What was that moment that turned you? Because you could turn the arena away, but you turned left.
Well,
and being in England too was different as well.
It was very. I didn't know anybody who. Basically, the deal was, I was at school. I was at this really weird exclusive school that I didn't like very much. And there was, I had two friends who, the three of us were actually a band together, and we were kind of. Pretty much social outcasts who listened to punk rock records, and initially it was, you know, The Clash and then NoFX and Descendants and that kind of thing. And I remember that we got into ordering stuff from mail order catalogues, because this is all pre music being on the internet kind of thing. We're talking, this is like 96, 97 kind of time.
Like what catalogues were
you? Initial Records was a big one.
Perfect.
Although that kind of came a little later, actually, because initially we found the underground hardcore scene in the UK, which is based around a label called Household Name Records, which is still running, and Lil is still a good friend of mine, I'm pleased to say. And that was at a time when, I mean, and this is a thing, remember distros?
Yeah, you'd go to a show and
then be a guy with
copies.
A suitcase with a distro, and that just doesn't exist anymore, like, at all. And I used to love distros, and Lil, Household Name at the time was kind of 50% label, 50% distro. So we picked up a few bits and bobs off him, and then and basically the way that it generally worked is one of the other guys was a bit more kind of well off than the rest of us, should we say?
Because it was expensive.
Yeah, and well, and the thing is, and but I mean, you know, to his credit, he would basically, we would sort of collectively consult on what records we wanted to get, and then we get them. And it was, you know, that beautiful age where you get a catalogue and you read the descriptions, or you'd read a review in Fracture Zine, which was the zine in the UK at the time, and you'd essentially, that's how you decide whether or not you're going to spend your money on music, because mm-hmm. there was no MySpace or YouTube or whatever to check this stuff out. So I remember very distinctly there was one day where we got a package arrived that had, and I remember I'd seen the word emo around, and also sort of melodic hardcore as a term was slightly confusing to me at that time. I remember that the first record I bought that had been described as melodic hardcore in a catalogue was Millencolin. So that was my benchmark for what melodic hardcore was. Whether or not that was right is an interesting debate. but I had that, and then basically, the word emo was kind of sort of floating around the edges of this stuff. And again, it's pre-Wikipedia as well, so it wasn't like there was anyone we could ask.
Yeah.
We didn't really know anybody who knew about this stuff. So we there was one day we ordered a batch of records, and I remembered really distinctly that one of them was a compilation CD of Spanish crust bands, and one of them was the first Boy Sets Fire record, The Day the Sun Went Out. And they arrived,
yes.
And we sat in the room, and we put on the Spanish crust one first, and it was bollocks. And I remember we sort of sat there, and that was the thing about that, because you'd a fair amount of money.
You'd sit through the whole thing.
And yeah, and if it was shitty, if you made a bad decision, then it was just kind of like, oh, bummer. Do you know what I mean? Like, we just spent 15 quid on a 20-track CD of utter toss and sort of sub-discharge nonsense. I should add, incidentally, that I love Discharge, and a fantastic band, but there's a lot of fans who copied them badly. Anyway, so we were there, and then I remember we put on the day someone out, and we knew that it was an emo core record, and it was sort of a point of interest. And the thing about that record is the first two songs on that record are both quite kind of standard, kind of 90s, slightly metallic hardcore. And I remember thinking, yeah, this is pretty cool. And the third track...
oh God!
I could lie.
Yes.
Here.
We'll get it.
Yeah, that one. When that kicked in, I remember just turning around, looking at Chris, and going, "What the hell is this?" And quite. I mean, I don't want to be too far at my own ass, but like, I remember we'd been discussing, you know, how we were into sort of Sick of It All, and we were into kind of Descendants and stuff, and I guess, you know, I was also, the guest at the time was listening to kind of The Bends by Radiohead and stuff like that, and it was like, wouldn't it be amazing if there was some way of kind of mashing those two kind of ideas, the sort of aggression on the one hand, and the melody on the other hand, and then it was like, we heard that, and it was like, fuck, someone's done it already, and that was just a huge, that record, it's to this day one of my favourite albums. And I must have listened to that record about 100,000 times, like, over and over again. And, you know, nowadays it's a little kind of naive, I guess would be a polite way of putting it, in places. Like, it definitely slightly strays into the kind of almost sounding like you're about to cry when you're singing kind of territory. But fuck it, it's still a really good album, you know. And that was the kind of epicenter record for me.
I thought they were going to be that band that was going to break. I was like, wow, they put together the hardcore part, but they're singing and it's melodic and it's catchy. But it was the bands right after them that kind of took.
Yeah. True. The other thing as well, and I want to be circumspect on what I'm saying here, because I don't want to be disrespectful to them as a band, full stop, and also Nathan, who I vaguely know is a nice guy. I felt like that first record is kind of qualitatively different from their others, in the sense that it has this kind of discordant, almost jazzy, melodic quality to it. Like, there's a lot of kind of weird discordant notes in it, and I felt that
chaotic,
like,
even.
Yeah, and when they, and melodically speaking, when they went forward from there, it got a little bit more just kind of run-of-the-mill melody to me, and I felt like something got lost. I never really was into that as into anything else they did off that first album, which makes you sound like a total hipster, but it's true.
No, but but in that moment, that's the record that connected, that's the record that someone gave
right,
you, or
totally.
You got and said, holy crap, this... Now, did that open up?
Completely. Well, after that happened, basically, we twigged the emo as something that we needed to know more about, and again, and you know, like I say, this is what—that's all that emo meant at the time to me, was essentially hardcore bands that had melodic sections, and it had nothing to do with diagonal haircuts and eyeliner and suicidal and self pity and all that kind of shit, you know, which all came later. And I still can't quite get my head around what happened there and who's responsible for it.
I mean, that's why I do the podcast. It's try and figure out, like, there's these moments that it turned, and where I was like, wait a minute, you're not talking about Elliot and you know, Mineral, you're talking about X band X, Y, and Z that everyone knows, that I've repeated a million times. Like, what happened?
Yeah, totally. But anyway, so we went off the deep end at that point, and I guess the bands that stand out for me personally from that time would be Gellert Kids. First Gellert Kids record, 4 Minute Miles, is a masterpiece to my mind. Love that record a lot. And then, well, you know what, I'll leave the next one I was going to say till last, because we're going to talk about that one for a while. You know, Christy Front Drive were cool.
How'd you find out about them?
All through distros and mainly mail order catalogues. I remember I got Righteous Spring because somebody told me that they were the first thing in my band, so I went about that. I have to admit, it's not a record I've ever really listened to all that much, because it doesn't do massive for me. I'm a huge Fugazi fan, but Righteous Spring was always a bit like, it was kind of like one of those records I bought because I kind of thought I should, and sort of
I actually had to buy, I bought mine in DC, like, oh, I really? Went to a DC record store, right. Bought Righteous Spring and Embrace, and the guy at the record store was like, nice, and I was like, I was like, sorry, I have to kind of buy these records here, I agree that you can see or hear what's kind of out of it, but I personally don't go back to it as much, just because that wasn't my time period.
Elliot, what was the band that was it Falling Forward, the band before Elliot? You turn the lights out on me, you turn the lights on the fires. Great
Chris
record.
Higdon should be in a mansion somewhere, like, he wrote so many hooks, man.
First Jimmy Eat World record, which again, all of this is making me sound like such a hipster, because I mean, I think Jimmy Eat World are a fantastic band, but I think that actually the EP, the Lucky Denver Mint EP, is always going to be my favourite Jimmy Eat World release. That's such a fantastic record. So there was that. I'm trying to organise my thoughts here. I'm getting excited about all of this. Cross My Heart was great. I used to say that a lot. One of the biggest ones for me was Mineral. And I remember getting End Serenading. Actually, got End Serenading first and then got Paraphailing afterwards. And that record, to this day, I actually think an awful lot of my thinking about music and
really?
Arrangement is influenced by that particular album. Particularly, I think that the drum, this is quite geeky, the drum sound on that record is the best drum sound I've ever heard in my life. And it's Mark Trombino record, and I really would love to record with Mark Trombino one day. I mean, he went on and did a lot of very successful records and ceased to be a cheap person to work with, I think, you know. But that the drums on that record sound fantastic, the guitars sound amazing.
It sounds new.
Yeah,
today.
It's like the sound of drums to me. It's not the only reason I like the record, but like that. And I remember at the time, and this is going to make me sound like a total sado, but it's true, I was so obsessed with End Serenading. And the thing is, I had a cassette copy of it because my buddy had ordered it from States on vinyl, and then I taped it off the vinyl. And I hand wrote out the lyrics to the entire album on pieces of paper and photocopied them, and then I gave the tape with the handwritten lyrics to a number of friends of mine and said, you have to listen to this.
We would have been friends.
Yeah, and it was just like, you know, and I mean, I played a Mineral song at that show in Austin on this tour, because I'm doing this thing on this tour of trying to play regional covers. So I did a cover.
Oh, no way!
Yeah, I covered GJS in Austin. And then
was Chris there?
Yeah, Chris was there, yeah, which was awesome. Chris, incidentally, he went on and he did the Gloria record and then Zookeeper, both of which are fantastic. And then what was the band that the other guys from Mineral did? They had that.
Oh, I'm blanking.
Pop Unknown.
Pop Unknown, thank you.
There you go, Pop Unknown. Yeah.
Great Hooks?
Yeah, Great Hooks. Great record. I felt like it... I mean, I don't want to sort of say that Mineral was just about Chris, because I don't think it was at all, but I felt like there was a certain something lacking from that Pop Unknown stuff. Me and my friends used to sit around and play... I can't remember the title of the song. The first track on the first Gloria record EP. This town has no
feelings. I'm always like track one, track four.
It's the middle of October and you think there'd be a nice cool breeze by now, but you'd be wrong. Great song. We used to sit around and sing that song all the fucking time. Anyway, Chris, I'm going to try and tell a kind of PC version of this story, because I'm pleased to say that I'm now a clean person, but I didn't used to be. I used to have my issues with drugs, and I actually met Chris at a house party in Austin whilst kind of doing bad things in the bathroom, like
Was this Zookeeper's era for
you? Yeah, this is like 2000 and 8 probably.
Yeah.
I used to be pretty messed up essentially. But I ran into Chris kind of in a kind of partying context, which was really weird because it was just kind of like, first of all, there was this guy and he was like, oh yeah, I used to be in a bunch of bands, or I'm in a band. And I said, oh, what was the name of the band? He said, oh, I was in a band called Mineral. And I went, fuck you. What? And he was like, yeah. And we ended up hanging out for an evening and kind of getting wasted together.
That's awesome.
Which was really fun and kind of a surprise, because I kind of figured, I mean, you know, one of the things about Mineral is that they were a pretty Christian band, which, you know, I mean, I'm an atheist, so that's not really my thing. But then, who gives a shit? The music's incredible. And indeed, I would say the lyrics are incredible. You know, he writes in a very moving way about Christianity, yeah. You know. I would not the kind of person I would expect to meet there and then. I really hope this doesn't slander Chris in any way. I'm sure he'll be fine about it. He's also in a much better place these days. But we hung out a few times, and he was in London touring solo, and we hung out there. And actually, one of my friends who I'd given the handwritten tape to, I had this night where I was away on tour and Chris was in London. He was like, do you know anyone I can stay with? So I called up my friend Chippy and I said, what are you doing tonight? And she said, nothing. And I went, cool, Chris from Mineral's going to be at your front door in about half an hour.
Yes!
And she was like, fuck you. No, he isn't. And I was like, yeah, he is. Anyway, so, anyway, back to the music. Mineral, yeah, just that. There's something about, I think that I quite consciously, in the back of my head, the way that Chris sings on Mineral Records is kind of how I'm sing, in a way. It's kind of, again, it's like my singer in a band voice.
Yeah.
In a way.
There's this, like, this sense of urgency and, I don't know, just... that's what I loved about his lyrics and
there's
delivery.
There's a desperateness to it. And there's also, I mean, he pushes himself to the top end of his register, which is something that I do as well. And I just kind of never really thought about it. I just always did it because Chris did, and that was my favorite record, basically.
Wow!
So that was all a big thing. The next thing we should talk about. Look at this. I'm leading.
That's
leading
fine.
The interview. Yeah.
I have questions, but go.
Well the other thing I was going to talk about was the UK thing, because basically, I mean, if emo was an underground thing here, it was at this period of in history. It was like so underground. I mean, so underground it barely existed in the UK. Like most people didn't know what the word meant, at the time, the hardcore scene in the late 90s and the hardcore scene in the UK probably comprised no more than about 500 people nationwide. I mean, it was so small. You do a tour and you would do London, Norwich, Peterborough, Leeds, and probably South Wales, and that was a UK tour, and those are the only towns that had enough people who would go to a hardcore show, kind of thing. It was so hand-to-mouth. And so all the shows would be a mix of metalcore bands and tough guy bands and straight edge bands and then kind of like drunk metal bands and then a handful of emo bands. In particular, a band called Spy vs. Spy, who I to this day think are just unimpeachably brilliant. Like, they were so fucking brilliant. That first EP they did was just like nothing else. Easily as good as Braid, mm-hmm. if not better, you know. And they came from the UK, and that was really exciting to me at the time. And I went to see them loads. And actually, the second gig I ever, well, first gig I ever played was opening for Poisonous Fire, because Lil from House of Man was putting them on their first UK tour, and me and the two other guys in the band basically tag team phone called Lil like 3 times a day until he finally went, for fuck's sake, do 20 minutes at the start of the set.
What year was that?
That was 97, I'm pretty sure, maybe 98. I can't.
The Day the Sun Went Out era.
Yeah, totally.
Oh,
and like,
that's awesome.
And I interviewed. I had a zine at the time, and
of course
I interviewed.
You did.
Yeah, totally. It was called Paper Cuts. It was the worst thing ever. And if anyone finds a copy, you will be killed by ninjas. I interviewed Nathan that day, which I was really excited about, and basically just completely fanboyed at him and
nerded
incredibly
out.
Hard. And then at the time, in the way that things are more intense when you're a kid than they are when you're older, I genuinely don't think I'll ever be as excited as I was at that show. I was like, I was in very heaven.
I always thought hardcore had, I mean, like Alexis would go over there.
Yeah, but that's
like,
a little later.
It was later then. So
that's
you're saying 97, 98 was still.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I guess Sick of It All would play, but I get, they were sort of essentially considered a metal band, really. In terms of kind of domestic hardcore, like I say, Household Name was, at the time, as far as I was aware, was the only game in town. There was also the Scene Fracture that was really important to the scene as well. And it sort of grew a bit over time. I remember there was a bit more going on by about 2000, 2001. Then Well, and then, so I was going to say, yeah, the second gig I ever played was opening for Spider vs. Spider, which was a huge deal for me, and they did a reunion show not so long ago, and I went down, it was incredible. And then there was, I remember there was a split CD that someone put out that had a band called Sun Factor, who are English but had an American singer, a band called Babies 3 from Margate, and another band, and it's really remiss of me not to remember what the third band were called. That's actually going to really bother me.
Should we pull out the internet?
I would be amazed if it was on the internet, to be honest with you. But yeah, so that was kind of a release. That was like, as far as I was aware, that was kind of the first UK emo release, them and Spy vs. Spy putting stuff out. Subjugation Records from Leeds were doing stuff, I remember that. And then...
Did it feel like a community? I mean, like, this is actually one of my questions. It was like, I talked to a band from the Midwest, so if I talked to Bob from Braid, we kind of talk about that, or if it's Mike Kinsella. West Coast had a different thing. East Coast, South, you sometimes connected if you toured, but in the UK, were there subsets, or was it small enough where it was one?
Yeah, it was small enough, both because UK is a small country, and also because there were so few people involved in this. But like I say, there weren't really any like emo shows. There were hardcore shows that would have emo bands on the bill.
Which is what it was. I thought that's what had happened. That's how I got into it.
Yeah,
I'd go see a hardcore band, and there happened to be Karate playing.
Right. Or whoever. My god, one of the fucking greatest bands of all time, Karate, incidentally.
Sorry, after we can turn off and I can help you out. But dude, the Karate,
I remember, like, seeing them at 93 Feet East in about 2000, I want to say, and it was one of the single most sublimely perfect musical experiences of my life.
That was my first interview I ever did for my shitty zine in high school.
Oh, really? Amazing.
They opened up for Fugazi in this town that I grew up in, and they did an email interview for me. It was their first one, the first interview they ever did. Yeah. They sent me their 7-inch.
Amazing.
And I was just like enamored.
I wrote Guy Picciotto an email with a bunch of questions in for my zine, hoping against hope that he might write back and answer
them.
He absolutely did. So I emailed him to Guy Picciotto when I was a kid. I think I probably asked him a bunch of stupid bullshit. I can't even remember now.
I think I scanned it in at one point. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, like, I mean,
what would a 17-year-old ask a band?
Yeah, right, totally. But yeah, no, Karate were incredible. That Cancel Sing EP is something else. Like, but all in fact, they're a band that I never kind of. I love everything they did equally. Like, incredible. Incredible stuff. But yeah, in the UK, I mean, you know, people generally knew each other, I think, because I was, okay, the next part of the story was I was in a band called Knee Jerk. Knee Jerk's aim in life was to be, I guess, a bit like Until Your Heart Stops Here or Converge. Oh, sorry, Cave-In, I should say, excuse me.
I just talked about that record today for like 45 minutes.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's an interesting record to me. I have mixed feelings about that one as an album. I think that it was kind of... It's a tiny bit too intellectual for its own good, is my feeling about that album.
But the breakdowns.
Yeah, well, and you know...
Juggernaut
is one of the fucking best hardcore songs of all time. But, like, but I just feel like, as a whole record, it's a bit too clever for its own good, you know what I mean? It's a bit more head than heart to me. Which is not true of all of Cave-In stuff, you know? And I just felt that record felt a tiny bit studied somehow. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. Knee Jerk, I think we called ourselves an emo core band, quite consciously. We did... But there's about to be some cringing going on here, because basically, in fact, pre Boy Sets Fire, the three of us had another guy. We had this Chinese guy on bass, and we were sort of a pop punk band called Badger Doritos, for reasons that are infinitely too stupid to talk about. But then we got Boy Sets Fire, and it was just like change. And the bass player quit because he thought it sounded like the Smashing Pumpkins. It was his ultra cuss. He was like, sounds like fucking Smashing Pumpkins. We were like, fuck you, man. And then, so we changed our name to Knee Jerk, and then we were a three-piece. I ended up playing bass because we didn't know anybody else who wanted to be in the band. And we wanted to be an emo core band, and we recorded... we called it an album. I mean, it had 12 songs in it. We recorded it in like one day in a studio in Hampshire near where I grew up, whatever. And it was, there's a couple of melodic ideas in it, it's going to be all right, but it's pretty intensely cringeworthy, generally speaking. The album was called, and this is, I'm going to die inside while I say this out loud. The album was called Helpless I Cry.
Wow, you guys really went for it.
Yeah, and it was just... Yeah, there was a lot of songs about feelings. But so we did that. Then we did a split EP with a band called Abjure, who are a kind of technical hardcore, technical metalcore kind of band in the sort of Converge vein. I should add, Converge were at the time, and indeed to this day for me personally, a very important band to me at around this time as well. Converge completely blew my world apart when I came across them.
The first record?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I think the first record of theirs I got was When Forever Comes Crashing, which I, to this day, is a record that gives me the heebie-jeebies. There's something really spooky about the way that record sounds. It's kind of sounds like it's kind of being piped down to the bottom of a well. I don't know. It's weird. Anyway, so Nijo, yeah, and we did that. Then we did a split with Abjure, who were a technical metal band, who are friends of ours from London, and we did our first UK tour together in summer '98, and then. We did 2 weeks and nobody came to any of the shows and we all got ill and lost loads of money and it was great. And we had a racist guy driving the van that was really, really odd because he was older than us and we were all scared of him. We were all like 16. Very strange time. We played a show in Leeds at a squat called 120 Rats and we sort of got jumped on a bill with End of the Century Party and Arsehole Parade, who are over from Florida, both of whom then broke up that night after the show in the car park when we were like, oh my god, what the fuck is going on? So we did that, and then we did a split EP with a duo called Don't Clap, It Startles Me. It was a very long and stupid reason for that title. Then we did an album. We actually scraped some money together and went and recorded with a guy called Dave Chang, who's actually a reasonably well-established kind of underground metal producer, and we did this kind of concept album called The Half-Life of Kissing that is insane. I mean, looking back on it now, for me, it's an insanely pretentious piece of work in its way, but at the same time I'm kind of impressed with myself for doing that shit when I was like 17, because it's essentially, it's sort of a concept record. It's themed around like the surahs from the Quran and stuff, mm-hmm. and like it's got all these like 7-8 minute long songs on it, and we did this one thing where we took a T.S. Eliot poem being read by Ted Hughes and cut it up and arranged the samples. There's a lot of electronic stuff on it because in the meantime we'd listened to Shape Punk's Come By Refuse and got really obsessed with that. But I still think we thought of ourselves as an emo band, and it was still pretty emo in places. And we did, Knee-Jerk did I think 3 UK tours, I seem to remember, 2 or 3, and we did a whole bunch of like weekend shows, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Drive up to the Woodhouse Community Centre in Leeds and play with a bunch of like Belgian hardcore bands and then us.
But that worked then still.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Like it wasn't like you had to sound this way, this package tour.
Yeah. Well, okay, now here's the next bit. And again, I want to be careful talking about this because I don't want to kind of blow my own trumpet too much. Basically, there was a divide in the scene in the UK. There was like a fissure in the scene.
What year was this?
2000, 2001, somewhere around there, I want to say. There was a very definite split where all of a sudden there were just hardcore shows and there were just emo shows, and it stopped being a combined thing.
Interesting.
I think by then there were enough people involved in it for that to sustain itself, was one part of it. And, you know, it was a bit weird. You'd have guys in, like, you know, basketball jerseys with X'd up hands beating the living fuck out of each other to Tough Guy stuff. There was a band called Beatdown Fury, I remember. And
I wonder what happens at their shows.
Yeah, and Beatdown Fury and you know, Some Factor being on the same bill was always a little kind of incongruous. The other thing, though, there was a degree of antagonism in which, well, it happened around the same time an incident happened that involved me, which was basically, there was a band called Knuckle Dust from London, who, incidentally, for my money, in the late 90s and early 2000s were unquestionably the best hardcore band from the UK, and I still listen to their records to this day. I think they're a fucking excellent band. They weren't at the beginning, they were quite sort of posicore, but they got a bit more into that whole sort of Tough Guy vibe as time went on. And basically I got taken out by their singer at a Sick of It All show, not deliberately, but he just kind of windmilled into me and completely fucked me up. And a week later I was doing possibly my first ever interview, and I mentioned this, and basically I think I called him a macho idiot. He then came down to an Knee-Jerk show and beat me up.
Wow.
which really kind of proved my point, I might add. And a lot of people got kind of fucked off about it. There was a Fracture message board which went with the zine, the Fracture forums,
mm-hmm.
very early like basic message board format, and there was a lot of kind of shouting it on there about it. And
we had Trustkill and Victory for those on the States, so.
Right? Yeah,
same,
yeah,
same problem,
yeah.
Thing. Yeah.
And then basically, I'm not claiming that incident was the moment when everything split in half, but that was definitely at a time when I think people stopped going to each other's shows, kind of thing. Which, I mean, you know, I remember at the time, I mean, I'm not sure. I think it's partly a function of being younger and partly a function of the time. There was all the... You remember debates about more women in hardcore, violent dancing, straight edge versus veganism? Does, you know...
Hard line.
Yeah, exactly. Like, violent, straight edge, all that shit. We actually... There was an Egypt song about violent, straight edge, which is the single most embarrassing song I've ever written in my life. You know, there was all those debates, which at the time mattered to me so much. And I remember kind of writing this sort of long post on the Fracture Forum about what a fucking shame it was that people had to go their own way and we could have had a unified scene and all this shit. With the benefit of hindsight, I'm not sure I really care.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But in the moment.
Whatever. But yeah, I was bothered about it at the time. By the way, I never ever talk about all this shit in interviews, and I'm really enjoying this.
Hell yeah.
Saying this to a million people about, to me, emo was supposed to be more intense than hardcore in a certain way, you know, rather than less.
It wasn't
supposed to, yeah, right. I mean, actually, yeah, two other bands, I should mention, American bands that I adore. One of my very favorite emo bands ever was I Hate Myself. And I had this really funny moment a few years ago. I was doing a show in Florida, and the in-house sound guy, somebody told me he was the drummer from I Hate Myself, and I slightly wigged out and got my photo taken with him. I think he thought I was fucking with him at first, because he was just like, no one cares about the band.
Yeah, no way.
And I was just like, I fucking care about your band. That song, Less Than Nothing by I Hate Myself, is like probably... It's one of my favourite emo songs of all time. And I used to play it to people because the vocals on the chorus are so fucking harsh and intense. And I'd say to people, this is what emo is. It's not soft. It's not softer than hardcore. It's not the light option in the hardcore world. It's supposed to be fucking more intense, you know. But them, and then Saisha as well, were a band.
Which one?
Saisha.
Oh, yeah.
Saisha,
both.
Saisha, who, weirdly, I had this thing. I was working, when I left school, I moved to London, and... here's another part of the story. The three of us in Nijo decided that when we left school, we were going to spend a year making a go of it and, like, doing DIY European squat tours and all this sort of shit, putting out our own records and blah, blah, blah. And then, so I made the arrangements to not go to university straight away and all this sort of thing. And then the band broke up, like, in August. And it was just like...
Well,
fuck.
I guess I know what I'm doing.
Yeah,
now.
So I went. I moved to London and did a bunch of, you know, was working kind of crappy temp jobs and office jobs and shit. And, a good friend of mine called John used to work at the UCL, the University of London, and I used to work at I was working at a shop at the time quite nearby, and we'd meet up for lunch every day in the university cafe because it was subsidised and I looked like a student, so they let me in and it was a cheap way to get lunch. Now, we did that for pretty much an entire year, and for the second half of that year, John's friend Billy came and hung out with us, and he was an American guy who John knew, and we'd shoot shit and we'd talk about music and it was all good. And then Billy left in sort of May or whenever it was, and to go back home because he finished his thing. And the next day, week, I saw John and I was like, oh, where's Billy? And he went, Billy from Saisha. And I went, wait, what? And he went, he was like, oh, he's come back to America. And I went, no, what? And he was like, oh, yeah, he was a singer in Saisha. And I was just like, you mean I've just been hanging out with a singer in Saisha for fucking 4 months and I didn't know, you dick. That was a weird one. Yeah, but Saisha, I don't know how to pronounce that fucking band name. There was a kind of that's pretty quintessentially screamo to me. Do you know what I mean? It was that kind of melodic but fucking intense.
Always thought of this band Frail from Philadelphia. Mm. If you haven't heard them, they're one of these ones where you feel like it's everything's breaking while they're playing, is singing. There's a moment, and also a Sleepy Time Trio.
Oh yeah, I know Sleepy Time Trio. Yeah.
They were like, just got to see them a bunch and just, you know, like kind of Engine Down, that sort of moments of everything. Hell, the floor is going to open up.
Yeah, yeah. That incidentally reminds me of something, which is that I remember when I first started touring in the States, you know, the first few tours I did over here, like, were real kind of DIY stuff, and generally just me and my guitar, quite often in a car and the van driving around friends playing shows. And I remember, getting to, because of sleeping on people's floors and stuff, and one guy's house, where the fuck was that? But basically, he'd saved every gig poster of every gig he'd ever been to. And the thing is, all of these American bands are talking about here, I never saw any of them live because none of them ever came to the UK because it just didn't happen.
Yeah, logistically, right?
And I remember getting into his house and just wanting to fucking strangle him because it literally, they had shows on, posters of shows on the walls for where it was like four of my favourite bands who I never saw live playing together. You know, the bill would be like Christy Front Drive, Mineral, Braid, Jimmy Eat World. And it would be like, fuck, man. Like, you know, I've seen Jimmy World, obviously, now, but, like, I'd never seen any of those fucking bands. There was that, and then also, I mean, going on, this was the sort of slightly parallel music taste for me at the time. There was one, I remember the bill was, like, Neurosis, Cave-In, Converge, and Botch on one bill. And it was just like, what? I'm not sure I could have handled that. I would have been so fucking excited about that show. You know?
I was listening to Botch yesterday.
Love it. Oh, fucking great, great band, Botch. I booked the first Botch UK tour with a friend of mine. Yeah, and we did a terrible job, and they didn't come back. yeah, we really fucked it up quite badly, actually.
So you were, I mean, it's interesting, the, you know, a lot of people that are on this, like, they come from the hardcore side. They've got maybe some indie, but they got into emo, and it kind of, maybe they were into post-hardcore for a little bit, but then it turned into emo.
Yeah.
What it was labeled as. Mm. And that sort of hardcore mentality of you picking someone up off the floor, going to the merch table after, like, you seem to have kept that, and that's something I noticed. I was like, all right, he's been to a show before. Like, you didn't go to just concerts.
There's no offense,
it's just like, that was what you did.
Absolutely. Well, you know, that's an interesting thing, because one of the things I always find is, like, you know, the live shows that we do, they're energetic, right? But, I mean, it's not particularly out of the ordinary for me, and it's kind of funny because I just find that for people, you can just tell straight away if people grew up listening to hardcore and or emo, or certainly the underground version of it. You can just instantly tell, because it's, people go, Jesus Christ, man, this, like, show's so fucking intense, it's so energetic. And I go, not really, not if you grew up watching Sick of It All play. Do you know what I mean? And indeed, Boy Sets Fire.
Or watching Converge.
Yeah,
play.
That's just how shows go.
Yeah.
That's what you do when you do a show. You move around that much and you get that sweaty. And you know, I don't consider what we do live to be particularly remarkable from that point of view. But it's just, you know, if you got, particularly being from the UK, because the thing is, when I was a teenager, Britpop was everything. And I hated it. I had a homemade t-shirt that said shit pop and got beaten up at school for wearing it. And, like, and you know, there was that whole Blur vs. Oasis thing. And I took great pride in hating both bands. You know, and actually, funnily enough, retrospectively, I did miss out on quite a lot of good music because I was so militantly not going to be into what other people around me were into. But, like, you know, I've got friends who kind of grew up. I remember, like my friend Dave is one of my best friends, actually my flatmate now. But when he would come and see either, like, Million Dead shows, he was just like, I just can't really handle it. I just don't really know what's going on. And it's like, I know, dude, that's because you grew up going to see Shed 7. Do you know what I mean? And, like, and
cast.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and there's a qualitative difference between the two. And not just in the intensity of the shows, but also, like you're saying, just that idea of the music is supposed to have a sense of community to it. And, yeah, you look out for each other. You make sure everyone's having a good time. And it's supposed to be intense, and the pit can get crazy and all the rest of it. But it's not like a metal show where people just literally beat the living fuck out of each other.
Yeah.
You know, there's a kind of community spirit to it. And yeah, you go into the most table and you check out the open bands. And also, as a band member, you don't fucking hide in the backstage room. You go hang out. You go watch the other bands from the crowd. That's what you do. That's how shows go. And, you know, and I hope that there's a sense of that extent in what I do now.
Well, it's also, too, I mean, your communication, too, with the fans.
Yeah.
It was just really funny. I was like, when I saw the Chris Simpson photo, I was like, everything's clicking, because the way that you communicate is what would seem like if it was Rick Rodney from Strife talking on stage, or Rabies from Warlords, and you, like, he's telling you something, and yes, some people were going to say bullshit, yes, it was hardcore, and some people were, you know, you kind of talk but not walk, but at least you're trying, and it's this, you're connecting, and you're being really honest. It isn't behind this veil. It's not behind anything.
Yeah, because that's the other thing. I mean, I think that, you know, I've been criticised a number of times, particularly in the British press, for being unironic, which strikes me as a very strange thing to be criticised for being. I mean, it's like, oh, check that guy out. He means what he says. Well, okay. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, and there are moments when it can be a little kind of naive and all the rest of it, but it's like, and that definitely comes from being into emo and hardcore. Absolutely, 100%. Just that idea of saying what you mean and meaning it, and and saying and being very direct and honest and open. That's what I learned from growing up with these bands. Do you know what I mean?
It
that's
wasn't superficial. It wasn't behind a music video. Yeah, well,
it wasn't kind of didn't have a poise to it and a kind of slightly tongue in its cheek and all that shit. Fuck off, man. I hate quoting myself, but I'm going to do it. So not that much, obviously. there's a line in the song on the new record, Four Simple Words, where it's like, you know, sex, drugs, and sins, like extra skins, but it's okay because I don't really mean it, you know. And it's a sarcastic line, obviously, and it's just that thing about just this whole thing of. Well, and it's why I spent my entire life rejecting the word rock star and that idea of, like, you know, this sort of persona. I don't like the idea of personas, you know. What the fuck is a persona? Because the point is, a musician isn't someone who comes out of the backstage. A musician is somebody who vaults over the barrier at the front to get on a stage, or indeed just walks because there isn't a stage because you're in a basement. That's what musicians are. They're not fucking people who arrived in a limo who are staying in a fucking hotel. They're the people who are actually sleeping on your floor later that night because they're on tour in a van. And again, you know, I hope that that is apparent in what I do.
No, I think it really does connect. I'm just noticing it as someone, and it is. You can instantly tell if someone went to a hardcore show,
yeah.
Or at least it just you can instantly.
Yeah,
it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I had a roommate that was into Britpop, so I sort of got the history of Britpop while I was getting him into hardcore and emo. And
like I say, I do feel a bit bad about the Britpop thing because like I didn't really pay attention to Pulp, and I completely missed Gomez, who are now one of my favorite bands.
Gomez is great.
I love Gomez. So that, do you know that song "You, Me, and Everybody"?
No.
It's a garment. It's kind of, I think it's kind of an album track, but it's. I think it's one of the more remarkable pieces of music that I know. I spend a lot of time listening to it and thinking about it and wondering how they did that.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So.
Now the thing that I always, starting the site in the late, like, mid 2000s, I started seeing a lot of press, and it wasn't U.S. based. It was a lot of UK based.
Mm-hmm.
Really latching on to the eyeliner, the hair,
yeah.
Like. It was crazy how quick it was like, yes, those magazines are Kerrangs and those are just like, you know, so quick to pop on those things. Being there, were you seeing that and going like,
yeah.
Why are you...
Yeah, it was infuriating at the time because, like I say, no one knew what... I think the thing that needs to be explained, though, that it always surprises a lot of people over here is that no one knows what hardcore means in the UK. As a style of punk rock. No one knows who Black Flag or Dead Kennedys and Minor Threat are. No one's heard of hardcore. It's just not a thing. Do you know what I mean? And I spent my entire childhood with people thinking I was into happy hardcore, as in the super fast Mickey Mouse vocal bullshit techno that I can't fucking stand. And you know, I'd say I'm into hardcore, and they're like, oh, happy hardcore. And I'm like, no, hardcore. What are you talking about? Hardcore punk. It's not really called that, is it?
Yeah.
Yes, it fucking is. You know, and it's just not a thing people know about. And emo, even less so, prior to... And yeah, I remember there was an Enemy issue, I think it was, or Kerrang, one or the other, where it was like a guide to emo or an explanation of what emo is, and it was really kind of facetious, and it was all about kind of, yeah, dyed black hair and eyeliner and all this shit.
Yeah, that's probably when I had my blood boiling.
Yeah, and it pissed me off so much at the time. And that, I mean, it pretty definitely, definitively right there is the day I stopped using emo to refer to any music that I liked, because it was like, I don't want to be associated with... those kind of fucking haircut pop punk bands, basically, with kind of Hollywood melodrama sort of slapped over the top of it, like too much fucking foundation, you know, real awful shit. And I guess I can see the sort of, I can sort of see the causal family tree link of how you got from one to the other. You know, I think Get Up Kids and Jimmy Eat World were sort of transitional bands. And I say that with enormous respect for both, and love indeed for both bands, because I think they're both excellent, excellent bands.
But it was that pop tinge to it.
Yeah, which
you
I think...
You started to hear it on the radio. Promise Ring, you were like, that could be on the radio.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, right, totally. And then suddenly it just all got sort of ironed out a little bit too much. And then, and I mean, and again, I sort of feel bad saying this to a degree, because I do think that they had their moments as a band, definitely. But I think My Chemical Romance was the kind of real kind of like... the fuck kind of moment, you know what I mean? Because suddenly it was that.
Was that the one that kind of was? What one broke?
That was the breakthrough emo band in the UK, I would say. I mean, Jimmy Eat World to a degree as well, because Jimmy Eat World did start doing very, very well.
2001. In the middle was
yeah. Although not quite as well as over here, I don't think. I don't know. I'm not entirely sure about that actually. But yeah, My Chemical Romance was huge, and suddenly they were emo, and that's what emo was. It was, and I mean, you know. That video they did, which is shot like a Hollywood trailer, which makes me want to claw my fucking eyes out, because it literally to me just looks like a fucking marketing department laughing at small children handing over their lunch money. Fuck off. Like, oh.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that I don't like the song, because I just think it's quite a good song, but it's just that sort of approach to it was just like yeah, it's not to my taste personally.
I mean, it was, to me, that was pop punk.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, except, well, yes, although the thing for me, though, is the pop punk was always a bit faster than that to me.
Yeah,
pop punk was...
Exactly, No Effects, it was, you know, Fat Records, but then I started to see, I'm like, okay, this is fast. Yes, you got a little hardcore in there.
Yeah.
But it was still, it felt like... You guys, that this is pop.
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's just slow pop punk. There you go. How about that?
We have a new term, everybody.
Yeah, mid-paced pop punk. And it was just kind of like. But also, yeah, just that whole kind of. And in a way, it sort of became a parody of what earlier had been a sort of commitment to complete emotional honesty in music, became this sort of parody of just kind of like people wearing eyeliner and saying they're sad the whole fucking time. And it was like, no, that's not. And it became a put upon, which was the exact opposite of what it was supposed to be, which was. Open and honest, and I, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I think that the original emo, what we've been talking about this whole interview, could be accused of being a little bit humorless at times, you know, and perhaps a little kind of taking itself a little too seriously. I think that's probably a fair cop.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was a genuine kind of, like I say, yeah, commitment to being into emotional honesty in the middle of it, and to have that kind of degenerate into this whole kind of like. One of my least favourite things, which is people in their late 20s and early 30s writing songs about being at school. Fuck off. It's dishonest. Do you know what I mean?
Because they're trying to connect to...
Yeah, because they're trying to sell records to 17-year-olds. Get fucked. Do you know what I mean? Like, how unintegral could you possibly be? You want a textbook definition of selling out? There we go. Anyway.
What about the... I mean, what... When did you see it... What... I guess the thing is, the UK, you know, I felt a lot of it from there. The press was, I mean, so big over there, and it really started to kind of filter here, where that, okay, well, that's what this is. It's goth, it's emo, and these bands are sort of, did you go under? I mean, a lot of these bands, I mean, hid.
they were
still putting out records, they were, like, hid, and now they're slowly kind of popping their heads out again.
Well, I think the thing for me, I mean, in terms of my personal history, Knees That Broke Up, I'd spent a year fucking around, not really doing anything musically, and then joined a band called Million Dead, which featured Ben on drums, who had been in Knees That as well. And Million Dead, I think I thought of Million Dead being at least in part an emo band, but it was interesting because Cameron, who was a guitar player in Million Dead, who was kind of probably, I would certainly on that first record, the sort of prime musical force. He liked Fugazi, but other than that, he was into stuff like Von Bondies and, you know, kind of like dirty guitar rock.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought the term emo was hilarious and or appalling, depending on who you asked. And I spent years trying to play him records that I thought he might like, and never succeeded. But in a way, the tension between what he was into and what me and Ben were into was one of the more interesting aspects of Million Dead musically, I think, because. I feel like with the tug and pull between those two things brought us to an interesting place. But the other thing that happened musically, and this is a band that can't go unnamed in this discussion, was At The Drive-In. Because At The Drive-In, At The Drive-In landed like a fucking bomb, as far as I was concerned, and indeed most people into rock music in the UK. In Casino Out, I'd been around and I was aware of their existence, and I'd seen their name in catalogues and stuff. But I didn't own that record. Then Via arrived, and I got Via and went...
Unreal.
Fuck. But not least because it was kind of... They were sort of... I'm not sure I think of them as an emo band. I think of them as a post-hardcore band more.
Yes.
But, like, they kind of took what I think of as emo and pushed it a bit further. And it was a bit nastier, in a way. Like, a bit more vicious. In a way that I liked a lot, and still do. And then Relationship with Crime came out, and everything. Everyone went, Jesus Christ, this is the best band in the fucking universe. Although terrible live, I have to say. Like, just the whole stopping songs because of people having fun. Come on, really?
There's a show I saw. Jimmy Eat World at the Drive-In and Lazy Kane tour. Mm-hmm. And there's someone posted a video of Fahrenheit. And it was... I don't remember it that good. Like, I was... Right. You know, you kind of just... Everything bleeds together. But there was a... I'd seen them off and on, and this was on.
Right,
and
right.
I think that's how they were sometimes.
I only saw them once, so maybe that's my thing. But they... But yeah, they... I feel like that set Million Dead and an awful lot of other people off down a slightly separate path, because post-hardcore sort of became an acceptable term for people who had been doing emo before emo turned into goth, essentially. This is so arcane what we're talking about here, it's hilarious.
And you could sing. It was like singing and screaming, but it wasn't screamo yet.
Yeah. But I mean, it's
more dissonant guitars, Quicksand, all that stuff.
Right. Million Dead definitely got called a screamo band a number of times when we started out, which was a term that I was fine with, but not everybody in the band was, kind of thing.
And most people knew what it meant, or knew what it knew the context to it.
Yeah, right. But then, well, they did and they didn't, though, because then the next thing that happened is Million Dead started doing quite well in a sort of more mainstream rock circles kind of thing.
I mean,
and
you were touring with like Funeral for a Friend, right?
Yeah. Who were definitely an emo in the post-change sense of the word. And again, I say that with all the love in the world for Matt and the boys, and their first record will always be have a special
place
in my
heart. Gets requested all the time at emo night.
It's also
connected to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Matt in particular, who's the guy in the band I know the best, I should say. Matt definitely, he was one of the guys who actually used to send out Fracture Zine, and he was like...
Oh, awesome.
He was definitely on the grassroots of that scene and knew exactly what he was talking about and what he was doing. But he, they slightly went in the sort of after the change emo kind of vibe to me. But yeah, Million Dead tour with them, and then all of a sudden we spent a lot of time telling people that we weren't an emo band because it was an association that we were uncomfortable with. And I don't think that we were, in either sense of the word, actually, at the end of the day. I think that was an influence on what we did. But I guess post-hardcore is probably a better term for who we were and what we were doing.
And that was until 2005?
That was till 2005. I mean, it went off in a slightly weird direction because Cameron, the original guitar player, left the band after the first album, and we got another guy in called Tom, who had been in that band Abjure, who did the split with Kneejack in the tour. So we'd known Tom for years anyway. Tom came in. Tom is one of the best guitarists I've been within 100 miles of. Incredibly talented guy. He's a strange dude in his own way. Everybody's a strange dude. I don't want to be rude to Tom. He's a nice guy. But he's quite sort of... quixotic with his music taste. He'll be intensely into one thing for like a year, and then suddenly intensely into another thing. I remember he and I got super into grindcore together, and then suddenly he was super into, and this was when he joined Million Dead, he was super into Failure and like Giant's Chair, bands like that, and that kind of, the second Million Dead record kind of started veering off in that direction to a degree, I think, because of his influence, which I'm not complaining about. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but that was what happened. Then Million Dead broke up because we all forgot how to be friends with each other, which sucked, and I started playing on my own,
which is interesting. I mean, it's like, it's interesting that roots a lot of people do. I mean,
yeah,
prior Jim hasn't done it yet. Jim, you know, Chris Caraba, I mean, Further Seems Forever, Vacant Andes. There's been a lot of these things, and you know, were you trying to go so far away from what it was, or was it?
Definitely. I mean, I always feel like I want to be careful when I say what I say now, because I don't want to, again, don't want to claim any pioneer status or anything, because as you've already mentioned, a number of people who did this route before I did, you know.
But each had their different reasons.
Yeah. I mean, the thing for me, all it is that there was certainly a moment, I think it's kind of dying down now, a few years ago, where fucking everybody who used to be in a punk band was suddenly doing a solo record, and it got slightly kind of like, this is sort of a bandwagon now, and then. And first, I don't like bandwagons. I always make me want to do something completely different. If everybody's doing one thing, I'm the kind of person who wants to go and do something else. But also, I don't know, it wasn't easy, actually. And almost everybody I knew laughed when I told them what I was going to do after Million Dead broke up. I'd been thinking about it for a little while, and we did a farewell tour. We knew we were going to break up at the end of the tour, kind of thing. So I'd had time to consider my options, and I started playing solo shows and acoustic guitar, and a lot of people, including like booking agents and management and stuff like that, just went, what the fuck are you talking about? You're an idiot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and like really, like we're really down on what I did. Also, the other thing is that Million Dead, in our last tour, we were doing sort of maybe like 500 people a show kind of level. And I went from that to playing to no one, like literally no one on a number of occasions. And that was, you know, let's be blunt, it was a blow to my ego. It was not easy to handle. I was like,
I was just playing
fuck
to all these people.
Yeah, and now no one cares. And, you know, I'd assumed that at least some people would go. And you know what, and some people did, I don't want to disrespect or forget those people. There were a bunch of Million Dead fans who came along for the ride, and I'm very grateful to them, I am to this day, but like it wasn't the same kind of numbers. First London show I did was in the corner of a room in a cinema, after Million Dead broke up I should say, corner of a room at a cinema for a screening of a film about something, I can't remember what now, and I played and there was like two people there, you know, and it was kind of, and I was like playing, I'm mic'd up, I'm, you know, and it was just like, fuck this.
Did it feel good?
It felt good. I felt like I knew it musically. It's a weird thing, though, because now, looking back on it now, that's a period of my life where, at the time, all my friends thought I was fucking mental, and I thought I had a plan. And retrospectively, everybody now thinks I must have had a plan, and I think I was fucking mental, because I can't quite get my head around what I was thinking at the time now. It seems like a strange
decision. You were figuring it out.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm pleased to say, and I'll say it reasonably loud and proud, what I was doing was just following where music was taking me as an idea and doing what the right thing to do was. And it's funny because I think at the time people appreciated that. Retrospectively, because I've been successful with what I do, every now and again people go, oh yeah man, you know, you jacked in hardcore for something that would pay the bills, kind of thing, which fucks me right off, actually, because it's like, it really wasn't how it was at the time at all.
Yeah.
And you know, the first few years of my solo career were pretty fucking bare, you know. They're not now, and that's great, and I'm pleased for that, but like, yeah, there was some real fucking like hand to mouth shit.
I mean even, you know, if it was touring with Jonah, you know, Matranga, or yes, like the Revival tour, like you were connecting with those.
Yeah, well, that was
older,
the thing.
You were in that community.
Definitely. I definitely had a lot of moments of kind of running into people who I knew about from that time. I mean, meeting Chris at that party or whatever was one. Jonah actually was on tour with Million Dead and Fuel for a Friend was how I met him, because Matt brought Jonah out to play solo. And I think that possibly not consciously but subconsciously influenced my decision to do what I did after Million Dead was done, because I'd seen him do it and do it well.
Jonah had such a, I don't know, just a beautiful way of bringing the room together.
Yeah.
And I loved that about,
yeah,
Yes, Far was great and all this stuff, but it's like he could really get everybody together.
Yeah, definitely. We did a lot of touring and indeed a split release together. And then, and I remember, meeting Chuck was a big deal for me, because Hot Water was a big band for me. And then Tim Avail, I used to fucking love Avail, man.
Time I staged Dove was in Avail show.
Oh, right. The thing I love about Avail is at the time when the hardcore scene was very uptight in PC, it was four fucking drunk dudes who put out a record called Dixie.
And a dancer.
Yeah, and it was,
and
just
Bobo.
Like, oh my god, what the fuck is this? It was almost like masochistic. It was like, yes, break my taboos.
Rise, rise, rise.
Yeah, yeah. Don't give a fuck. What is that? Yeah, I did it as a joke initially, but the thing is, it's quite hard to have a logo as a singer-songwriter. Do you know what I mean? It's a weird thing. And so I sort of did it as a joke, and then it's kind of really now taken on a life of its own, which I like. I think it's kind of cool. And there's a lot of tattoos out there with that, which is now something I'm comfortable with, though. I went through a bit of a kind of what the fuck kind of about that. But yeah, it's fun. Although it's funny, it's not in the artwork for the new record, which is a genuine admission of just forgetfulness on my part. And then loads and loads of people went, oh my god, you're trying to reject your roots, man, now that you're working with
one
Inscope
mistake
records.
And you get like,
yeah, and it's
killed.
Just like, oh come on, cut me a fucking break. It's not like I'm not fucking doing stuff, do you know what I mean? It's not like I'm just sitting on my ass. The new record's out. I sort of feel like I sort of slightly don't want to sully this interview. I feel like this has been a wonderful moment of talking about something totally different from what I usually talk about. But I don't
want to feel like I'm paying the bills for it.
No, that's right. A really fun moment, a half an hour of my life.
Awesome.
About something I never talked about.
Well, Frank, thank you, and keep the hardcore dreams alive.
I will do. This has been such fun. For evening, for the day to be done, and some summer days I hide away and wait for rain to come, 'cause it turns out hell will not be found within the fire.